The following is a conversation. It has the features of any conversation, such as imperfectly expressed thoughts, ill-considered opinions, and the notions of several sleep-deprived brains. Try not to get your stethoscope in a twist about it.
Anyone here grew up in a small town or maybe on a county road?
Yeah, I grew up in Kelowna, Iowa, so about like 20 minutes south of here. Was an FFA kid, showed dairy goats and dairy cows and vegetables and flowers at the state fair.
Nice.
I was surrounded by hog confinement buildings.
Yeah.
My closest neighbor was like about a mile away, so.
Yeah. So I have this idea that small towns are sort of very tightly knit.
Yeah, it is for sure.
Everybody knows everybody else, and which always kind of sounds like a euphemism for the idea that everyone knows where the skeletons are. Mm-hmm. Is that also the case?
I would say so.
Like Joe knows what Mayor Jennings did when he was 16 kind of stuff, or.
Mm-hmm.
Or the patrons at the Curly Q salon talking about that young doctor who just moved into town, and it'll be interesting to see how they get on with Lois Grady. And
I'm pretty sure that this is like a Lifetime special that he's describing right now.
Yes, absolutely.
Most of my ideas about small town life I got from Stephen King's Needful Things.
I thought you were describing a Hallmark movie.
I mean,
it could be that too. Like
Hallmark
if it were more wholesome, yes, but it's got a dark tint to it, so it's probably Lifetime.
I don't know. I'm just saying that, you know, so Stephen King's Needful Things, I'm not going to really explain it very, very much, but basically it's about a town that sort of self-destructs with the arrival of a devil character who opens up a shop called Needful Things, and he sort of pits the town against it. All the things that the townspeople know about each other, he pits them against each other, and it's recommended book. I don't think the movie was as good, but, you know. You like horror.
So that's been riffed on several times in pop culture, but I will say my favorite version of it is Lois Lowry. She's the person that wrote The Giver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She has her own take on it, and it's much more optimistic in its finality.
That's good. That's probably good. I grew up in not small towns on the East Coast. Getting your ideas from Stephen King's version of Maine, it's probably not accurate.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, the show that gives you an inside look at medical school from the students drinking from that fire hose. It's a production of the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. With me today in the SCP studio here in Iowa City. Most mornings, you'll find her over at the diner talking about how kids these days don't know how to work. It's M1 Fallon Jung.
Ugh, kids these days, they never know how to work.
She's once again in charge of organizing the county fair's baking competition. It's PA1 Olivia Quinby.
Hello, hello.
Her sow, Sweetie, took 6th overall 4-H market hog in 2021. It's MD, PhD student Faith Prohaska.
Sweetie was robbed.
And joining us from our Des Moines studio, as charming as a butter cow sculpture, it's M2 Jeff Goddard.
And just as sweet.
Yes. If you thought that was all short coats, we have a guest this week, something that saved me from all manner of dumb ideas I might otherwise have had for today's show. Dr. Peter Caboli is a professor of internal medicine here at Iowa, an alumni of the Carver College of Medicine, and executive director of the Veteran Health Administration's Office of Rural Health. He's here as part of our sleeper specialty series, where we talk about areas of practice that you might not immediately think of when you think of medicine. Dr. Caboli, welcome to the Short Coat Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. I've heard all about it. Long time listener, first time caller.
You lie. That's all right. I'm so glad you're here. Yeah, I probably shouldn't accuse our guests of lying on the show. That's
you were accurate.
Yeah, it seems I asked you to be on the show because, you know, rural medicine is something that we in Iowa find to be important. I mean, our state is largely rural, unlike some other areas of the country. And I know it's not a specialty in the usual sense, but it kind of is a specialty in a way, maybe a patient population or something that somebody might be interested in. And so we felt like it was important to talk about and kind of give people an idea of what it means to practice medicine in a rural context. Is there a definition of rural that the professionals use? Because it's sort of a little bit squishy.
We gave a whole cyber seminar on that last week, and the definition of rural is anything that's not urban.
Okay.
In fact, actually, between the Census Bureau, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and eight other federal agencies, none of them can agree on what the definition of rural is. And the numbers of estimated rural inhabitants go anywhere from about 3 million to, well, let me put it this way, in percent, from about 3% of the population to about 30% of the population, depending on which definition you use. And so when you have a tenfold difference in definitions, it's really hard to narrow down what is rural. And a lot of that depends on what you're defining it for, whether it's for funding purposes or for healthcare reasons. But in the VA, we basically say that if you're in an urbanized area, you're urban. And then we have two categories of rural and then highly rural. Mm. And that's how we define it.
Okay. What would you say are some of the unique features of practicing medicine in a rural setting?
You know, there's sort of the stereotypical ones, like, you know, hey, I'm in this small community, and like you said, everybody knows each other and knows everybody's business, and, you know, you really are part of the community. But then I think there are the more sort of pragmatic things about, you know, how do you practice there? And I'll give four categories that we think of, and then y'all can go from there on what you want to ask. So one is workforce. Workforce is always one of the biggest things we talk about in rural areas. But shocker, there's workforce problems everywhere.
Yeah.
We don't have enough healthcare workers currently, whether it's in an urban area, rural area, suburban area. So it's not unique to rural. It just has unique issues in rural areas. Two is geographic distance. Everything's farther away. That's one of the hallmarks of being rural. But I guarantee all of us knew how far Walmart was when we grew up, because everybody knows where everything is. It just happens to be a little further. But how you overcome geographic barriers. Three is broadband and telemedicine and the digital divide. Those are all issues that are fascinating. But with the advent of low Earth orbit satellites, i.e. Starlink, there is not a part of this country that is not covered with broadband right now. And fourth is social determinants of health. And that could be a whole nother program on what are the issues of social determinants of health in rural areas. So,
yeah, I wanted to start with the scope of practice that physicians and PAs and, you know, people in healthcare have to deal with in rural medicine, because, you know, there are more specialists in urban areas. So that leads to its own unique issues.
Yeah, I mean, I can say I grew up in a town of 800 people in southeast Iowa in Lee County. Shout out for Donelson, Iowa.
Yeah.
My dad was the doctor there. And, you know, he was a general practice doctor. He did everything. He did general surgery. He did OB. He did GYN. He did pediatrics. He did everything. And so people just kind of would show up to our front yard sometimes with medical problems, and they'd be right there. So he kind of had to take care of everything. I think that's changed, and been in a good way. I think a lot of it has to do with when you practice in an environment, you have to know what your limits are, and you have to know where the help is. And yeah. I've covered in small town areas, and it's like, you're the only person there. It's like, okay, this person needs to get out of here before something bad happens. Mm-hmm. Or, no, we can handle this. We know how to manage this.
Something that's really interested me as somebody who like wants to go into primary care is, because there are so few specialists, what are things that you must know as a primary care physician in a rural setting that a lot of the times are sort of dealt with specialists in other places? So for like something that I think of all the time is like a good skin check, right? Like people go to the dermatologist for that. But like, I feel like a good primary care physician should be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, through your training, especially if you have the mindset of that you're going to go into a rural area, you will constantly have this idea of like, God, this is something I really need to know. Like, I think that's a great example. Basic office dermatology, you will be good at that because you can freeze off AKs, you can do biopsies, you can, you know, cut off other things that aren't supposed to be there. That's no problem. But then when you see that, you know, lesion that, oh my God, this actually could be melanoma, you need to be in to see somebody else now. And let's get you in to do that. I think another good example is basic office urology. I remember as a internal medicine resident, you know, so my fellow residents were like, oh man, I got to do this urology resident. I'm like, rotation. I'm like, I think this is awesome because I don't want to do urology, but I want to know what I need to know so I can do it in a primary care setting.
Yeah,
I feel like that's actually good advice for a lot of medical students when they're doing their rotations. And we've said this before on the show, like go into your rotation, even if you're not going to go into that thing, go into your rotations with the understanding that you're going to learn a few things that you're going to need in your future specialty, or that you might see in your future specialty that you might not end up dealing with, but it'd be good to know that these things exist and how they work.
Yeah, if I can add to that, and it's not just for your patients, it's for your friends and family too. Because I tell the kids who are going into psychiatry and they're on medicine rotation, I said, hey, I know this is not what you want to do, but you need to learn a few things over this next month, because your friends and family are going to have hospitalizations for pneumonia or heart failure or COPD, and they're going to look at you as the doctor, even though you're a psychiatrist. I mean, you are a doctor, but you should be able to answer their questions.
Yeah.
So I just finished my family medicine rotation here in the Des Moines metropolitan area. So not rural, but same general vibes to some extent, just a little easier to get to a specialist. And I was surprised to see it was very heavy on mental health, which I'm glad that, you know, people have access to that, right? So in their practice, they have a therapist in office, because it's like, I'm going to refer you across the hall because this is something that we need to address. But that, you know, he's been specialized in psychiatry. He's just a family med guy who spends a lot of time learning that stuff so he can provide that service.
Yeah. And in fact, actually in the VA, we have what we call primary care mental health integration. Everything has to have an acronym, so it's PCMHI. So primary care mental health integration is exactly what you just said. Is like, you're in your primary care clinic and there is literally a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a counselor embedded in the clinic. And when you see somebody that they could be in crisis, or they could just be having an exacerbation of some other underlying mental health issue, you can say, hey, I get you down the hall like today to see somebody. Because, you know, in primary care, it can take a lot of your time focusing on mental health. And it's super important. But there's also other people that might be better at it than you.
So I was thinking OB is often an issue.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. Because we just had a lecture a few weeks ago that Iowa is pretty low in OB gyn providers.
Yeah, so personally, I went into internal medicine and I ran as far away as possible from anything obstetrics related. So I'm not the best person to answer that. But I think, especially in family medicine, but the challenge with that then is you have to be in an environment where you're doing enough OB to maintain skills, that you have support in the hospital. You know, call every third night, you know, for OB is exhausting, you know, for your lifestyle. So it's a matter of trying to figure out what are the critical services that need to be maintained, and what are the ones that just have to be regionalized. And it's a long-term problem in rural hospitals. You can't do everything. So what are the things that you focus on, and what is a reasonable distance to go?
I had a lot of respect for the practitioner that I was working with on my rotation. And he said there was a procedure that's kind of a run-of-the-mill type thing, but it's not something that he's done a lot. And he told the patient, I'm going to refer you out. And I asked him about it. You know, he'd like talked to the patient about, you know, reasons why and everything. And then I talked to him about it afterwards. And he said, honestly, when you have something like this, it's just specialized enough that you want the guy that's done it 300 times a year, not the guy that's done it 3 times over the last 4 years, you know? And I was like, yeah, I had a lot of respect for him to be able to say like, this is beyond my, I don't have the ability to do this well.
I'm thinking of how I approach DIY home projects, which is, you know, the sure, I could do it, but it's going to take the plumber 10 minutes and it's going to take me, you know, a couple of days. And I feel like when you're talking about human bodies, you know, anesthesia, being under anesthesia for a long time is an issue, maybe, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mean you don't just learn all that stuff off of YouTube?
I mean, maybe you could.
I just joke.
I don't know.
I'm just saying, Dave, anything that takes one practitioner 10 minutes, if it's taking you a couple of days, we got a problem.
I'm not very skilled, and I take a long time to think these things through. So it's
it's like 5 different visits to Menards.
And yes, exactly. You don't want a doctor who has to do that. That's.
I will say though, working at a regional, like a more rural ED, once there was like one doctor on staff. I remember one time he's like, "Yeah, I have a general idea. Like, I've seen this procedure before. I've done it before, but it's been a long time." He did definitely just like watch a video online to like refresh himself. And he's like, "Well, let's go and do it, because it's like it needs to be done. There's nobody else to do it. You have to have enough confidence in your saying like that. You know, this is the best we can do, and so we're going to do our best." And I thought that was really impressive.
Well, that's getting into things like resourcefulness and you know, sometimes innovation, which I gather is another thing that you have to be when you're practicing with limited resources and equipment and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think having experiences both as a medical student and in residency where you get to go to alternative places that are just not UIHC or just not the Iowa City VA are really valuable. During medical school, when I was here at University of Iowa, I guess I've been here a long time, went to Guatemala, did things there where he had a lot less resources and had that opportunity. And then when I was in residency in Utah, I went to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, Alaska, and completely different environment there as well. So, you know, I encourage, you know, students to take advantage of those opportunities because you'll learn a lot by just being in a different setting. How they do things, how they don't do things, what resources they have or don't have.
Yeah.
So I was in South Africa this last summer and, you know, worked at a regional hospital and a regional clinic. And that was definitely my biggest takeaway. Not that I thought that they knew less than us or anything like that. But, you know, as a early medical student to just be like, wow, like they know the literature as good as any physician I've met in the United States. You know, they're on rounds citing papers, like they know their stuff. But their resources are limited, and that changes significantly how they approach their practice. And that was, I don't know, very eye-opening for me.
So what is it, so there's a potential, I would imagine, also for some professional isolation in situations like that, mitigated maybe somewhat by our internet age, but...
Yeah, no, and that's something actually we both study and try to overcome. And some of the work we do in our Office of Rural Health is choosing to live in a rural area. You know, it's a choice. You know, now some people do it because of financial reasons or family reasons, but you know, you have a choice. But what can you do to make that experience meet your needs? So one of the things we find is definitely the, you know, connections virtually, having those people that you can reach out to for virtual consultations. We're actually developing a program in the VA right now where it's kind of like a real-time Uber type thing where instead of asking for a car, you're asking for a cardiologist, and there'll be cardiologists that'll be circling around waiting to get pinged to be able to answer your question. The problem with it is getting it set up because you have to have the supply and the demand meet each other, you know, in the middle, because otherwise if you have a bunch of questions that are going out there and nobody can answer them, it's not valuable. And if you have a bunch of cardiologists sitting around with nothing to do, it's not efficient. So we're trying to do things like that to link people up. The other thing is you'll find is that providers in rural areas actually disproportionately go and do like missions and go other places because a lot of those people have chosen to live there because of that desire to serve a community, and they want to go and serve other communities. And so there's actually been papers written about, you know, the, you know, whether it's going to South Africa or, you know, South New Mexico, you know, it's like you're going someplace else to serve a community.
So that's really interesting because, you know, I think there's a tendency for a guy like me who grew up in a relatively populous area to think of serving in a rural community as a sacrifice. But I don't think that's, you know, that's sort of my initial knee-jerk reaction. But I don't think that's true for a lot of people. It's what maybe what they were called to do or maybe what they want to do, right? Like I know Olivia, you're into... you want to go back to your community, you've said on other shows, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and I think being from a small community and experiencing like limited resources, needing to be referred to a specialist, but having to be like waiting for 3 to 4 months to even get that first initial appointment is what really opened my eyes of how limited we are in healthcare in these rural communities. And the only way to really try to bridge these gaps and bring awarenesses into that is to really try to go back to those communities and serve in that way. And I think having that background experience helps me like approach my practice from a different way too, of like, I know I'm going to have to like screen patients for skin cancer pretty regularly. So I think having that helps, but I also think being from a rural community by like living on a family farm can probably put maybe like a job restriction on some individuals too, of like not being able to get into medicine or have those other experiences. Cause I think there's a lot of social, not like pressure or constraint, but some boundaries and limitations for some people too.
Yes, I think like what you're talking about is like if you've never seen somebody like you doing that, then it might not even occur to you that that's it's possible to go into medicine.
Yeah.
You know, like it seems like a crazy thing to do.
Just one of the things that I talked to the provider that I did my family medicine rotation about, because I'm maybe to a fault driven by responsibility and like, you know, like we have a duty to do this or we owe people this or whatever. And that can get kind of preachy sometimes. And I recognize that as one of my many faults.
No.
Flaws. But when I was talking to him, I'm like, you know, we have this responsibility towards primary care and rural medicine and these kinds of things. And like, how do we, you know, convince medical students to like take up that responsibility? And he's like, as a primary care provider, you know, I was asking him and he's like, oh, you and I are on totally different pages here. I do this because I love it. You know, if I didn't, I wouldn't do it. It's not altruistic. It's I love the hours. I love the variety of the job. I love that every patient is different. I'm not seeing the same disease over and over and over and over. He's like, you know, the pay is really good for what I do and the number of hours that I work. I'm really enjoying my life. And I think kind of to your point, Olivia, is this idea that how do we get people to fall in love with this? It's helping them know that this is something that we incentivizing by helping them figure out the things about it that they love. If it's, we want people in rural communities, we don't want people sacrificing to do it and they're going to be miserable doing it. You know, the ones that like, well, we'll repay your tuition if you do this for 5 or 10 years. And then like the second that it's done, they leave. That's probably not the person that's helping the community long-term, right? So how do we find incentives that actually help? Well, part of it, yeah. Let's make sure that we're actually recruiting from these communities. Let's make sure that we have the STEM programs available for them to be able to feel like medical school or PA school is actually an option for them and that they can go back and thrive in their communities doing that.
Yeah, I think you hit a lot of important points right there. I mean, and I think one is that money isn't solving this problem. You know, the problem of getting people in there, you just can't pay people enough to just move there because of the money. You have to want to go there. I think the other thing you said reminded me of when I was on my third year rotation in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, with John Bennett, who just retired recently as an internist. And I remember him. We were in this room with a patient and spent all this time talking about the guy's horses and his draft horses and what he was doing with the horses. And John had horses. And then when he was done and he left, I said, man, you guys spend a lot of time talking about horses. He goes, I wasn't talking about horses. I was talking about his heart failure. I was understanding what he could do in the context of managing his horses and his heart failure and his symptoms. And are his medications managed correctly? He said, that wasn't about horses. That was about him. But he said, ultimately, it comes down to the relationships and the people. Because he said to me, and I explicitly remember this. He goes, Peter, it doesn't matter what you do in your career. You're going to do the same thing every day, whether it's pediatrics or neurosurgery or pathology or radiology. It's the same thing all the time. It's the people that you work with and the relationships that you develop that will become meaningful to you over time. And I agree 100% with that. And that's why I do what I do.
Shortcoats, if this episode is worth listening to this far, it's worth sharing. So blast us on your socials. And if you want a sticker for your trouble, send us a screenshot. Thanks.
What do you guys think? Do we spend enough time in medical school talking about that side of it? Because I feel like, you know, most of the time it's about science and all the other stuff that goes along with it. But there's Fallon is in the midst of
deep thought
of that situation. But it's hard to understand. It might be harder to understand those connections that you. I mean, everybody sort of knows intellectually, you know, you want to develop a connection with your patients, but it seems like I don't know what I'm trying to say. It seems like it's kind of hard to focus on telling people like what the actual important stuff is beyond the science.
So I thought about this and I've talked a lot about it. My wife is also in medical school and she is pretty interested in pathology. And we've talked about what does that mean for the relationships that you're going to have with people in your career, right? But I don't think that I've ever had it discussed in an official capacity through school. Maybe somebody else can speak up and say if they remember something different. That's something that we've kind of had to figure out for ourselves. You know, like I think primary care is incredibly romantic. This idea that you have this long-term relationship with somebody, that you get these small touches that gently nudge them toward healthier lifestyles, because ultimately it's up to them, but they need your support. They need that unconditional positive regard. I think it's a beautiful thing. And if that's something that I'm interested in, then I'm probably going to lean that way. My wife, she wants to get into the nitty-gritty details, the really nerdy stuff. And so for her, it's more about being around coworkers that can talk shop with her. And that's where she finds meaningful and valuable relationships. And I think the fact that she knows that about herself at this point is kind of nice. But I don't know that we've really talked about that. I think a lot of the times we talk about, well, you know, on this rotation, see how the residents are or see how the attendings are. Well, like that's a small part of the relationships that you have.
Yeah, that's what I think that's what I was trying to get at.
I think it gets touched on in like specialty interest groups of like why people chose to go into whatever they chose to go into, that those kinds of relationships and the like role you have in people's lives, like in your patients' lives, does get discussed, but I don't think it's a formal part of the curriculum, and I don't know how you would put that in other than like in a specialty fair where like people are talking about something like that.
It's sort of one of those things that you can intellectually talk about, but you know, when it comes to the you know, sort of understanding what it means. It's like telling people it's like telling people med school is hard, you know, like you don't know what that means until you actually do it, you know.
Drinking from a fire hose as an analogy means something totally different once you realize what it really means.
Yeah, exactly. Jeff?
So I would say that it belongs in at least orientation week for rotations. That's a great time for somebody to stand up there for 15 minutes and say, like, no, I want you to really pay attention to the relationships that you're going to have with your coworkers, the other medical providers, and the patients, and what relationships they have with each other. And see what of those appeals to you, because it's not just the medicine that you're practicing. It's not just the lifestyle that they have, like, you know, is your attending showing up in a Porsche or not? It's the relationships that they have both with their coworkers and with the patients, and to really try to pay attention to that and see what feels right for you. I think most of us are, unless you're actively doing that, I don't know. Yeah, I guess you can kind of passively maybe do that, but I feel like that's kind of hard, you know, getting at the end of a rotation and being like, well, I kind of vaguely remember this person. Mostly I was just looking at Anki cards, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can say that I ride a bicycle to work, so I know the medical students are really impressed with that. But no, I think the term, the issue of like of modeling behavior is so important. And I remember when I was in medical school, there was always a sort of negative thing about the hidden curriculum and, you know, what is it that they're modeling that's bad, you know? And I think it's not so much that. Oftentimes it's modeling what are just the realities of practice. And for me as a hospitalist, it's funny, I thought I was going to really like the long-term relationships with patients, but the more I did internal medicine, the more I was like, I love the really short-term, deep relationship that I have with a patient for 2.3 days, and then I discharge them. I mean, and I learn a lot about patients in that short amount of time, and their families, and calling their families, and talking to the families in the room. And that's, to me, that's really meaningful. And I think the same thing, like you said about, you know, your partner and liking pathology, and what is the relationship in, you know, with the surgeons, and sometimes with families, sometimes with, you know, other specialists. And that's great. That's what we all have to figure out, because in the long run, that's what's going to matter. You know, seeing one more patient with X disease or some new condition is ultimately not that interesting, my opinion.
I will say my favorite rotation so far was newborn nursery. Just that first 48 hours, just goo goo gaga, and then off into the world. I'm a huge fan.
I imagine that physicians in these smaller communities also have an impact on the health of the community as a whole, as well as the individual patient.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I think medical schools and in training, they really talk a lot more about population health, health of the community. You know, I think in many ways we've had a divide between rural public health and rural health. And I didn't actually really appreciate that until a couple of years ago. I was on this panel that was on rural public health, and I was talking about something that was healthcare related, and somebody corrected me and they're like, that's not rural public health, that's healthcare. I'm like, I don't know if there's a, I mean, there may be a distinction, but
they,
I don't
seem
think
linked.
They seem kind of important to go together. Like, we're talking about rural public health. And I'm like, I get that, but These are all connected together. And I think the more we think of these as a continuum and as complementary and not like two separate silos of approaching care in a rural community, the better off we all are. So, yeah. So population health, very important.
It just occurred to me that during the crisis parts of the COVID pandemic, there may have been a big role for in rural communities for physicians to impact the health of their community, the public health of their community. Did you see that?
Yeah. And what was interesting about it was, you know, and we all experienced this in different ways, but you know, as the pandemic was really ramping up, we saw the worst of the worst, whether it was in New York City or the Navajo Nation. You know, there was like these outbreaks where people were dying and, you know, they were bringing in refrigerator trucks, and that's terrible. But at the same time, there were all these other rural communities that they didn't really have anything going on, and they shut the hospital down and they're not doing any elective procedures, and everybody's just kind of waiting for it to happen. And then leading up to the vaccination, you know, programs, and some communities embraced that and adopted it to protect their community, and others had challenges with that.
So, yeah, so I imagine that physicians in those communities had to sort of navigate that in a very, you know, close up way that maybe others didn't experience. Yeah,
I'm sure plenty lost friends or, you know, stopped speaking to people because.
Well, that's another part of being a physician in a small town is how closely integrated you are with the community. You know, these are not just your patients, they're your friends, they're your family, they're people that you count on, and they're people that count on you. And must have been a tough situation to be in.
I can't imagine how more complicated the decision gets of like having a conversation with a patient about this is the action that needs to be done, like in order to like best protect your health and like your family's health. And the different way that you would approach that conversation between knowing that that person can walk down the block and go to a different doctor if they don't like what you're saying, but like they still have access to care, versus if the next person that they would go to is so much further away to the point where they may not go to the doctor anymore.
Yeah.
Like they would lose access to medical care in a community that, at least from my experience, is already a little hesitant about like seeking that out, and is like, no, I can just do it myself. Like, I don't need, we have glue. I can just like take care of that to quote my grandfather.
Well, I think there's a flip side to that too, which is as a practitioner, when not only are you trying to make sure that you maintain that relationship because if they don't stay with you, they're not going to get any healthcare. Right. And I think that makes you better at meeting the patient where they're at, instead of being able to just like shrug off their complaints, or, you know, if we have disagreements. And for example, I've heard people in the past say that they feel very strongly that they don't want to take care of pediatric patients that haven't been vaccinated because it puts their other patients at risk. And I can understand their argument, but when you live in a rural community, it's like, you're gonna let them die? Like they've got no other access to care. Yeah. And all of a sudden you have to have entirely different conversations. So I think that it asks a different set of skills from the physician, and that gives them an opportunity to develop as a person in a different way, which I think is kind of beautiful. But I'm a romantic, so
clearly.
One thing that I'd like to ask about is behavior change with your patients. I'm sure you see, or you have to try to implement it all the time in the VA and just in general. It's one of the things that people struggle with the most. Sorry, my eye has been twitching for a week.
That's medical school. Yeah.
It's okay, it's radio.
Yeah. Now they know. There are a whole bunch of different studies starting to go on, have been going on since, you know, early 2000s, 90s. How do you even go about it besides building a positive relationship with your patients?
Well, I think that's probably the best thing right there is, you know, build relationships that then engenders trust and understanding. And I think what you're saying about meeting patients where they are, you know, it's, you know, stages of change. And, you know, are you willing, you know, do you want to talk about quitting smoking? Do you want to talk about vaccination? Do you want to talk? And sometimes they're like, hey, I'm not ready for that. I don't want to go there. But like, hey, we'll see you back, you know, and maybe we'll talk about this next time. And it is challenging. You know, my experience as a hospitalist in the VA, a lot of that relates around substance abuse, especially alcohol use disorder. You know, we admit a lot of patients and take care of a lot of patients with alcohol use disorder. And you know, the good thing is we have incredible resources, and I can get them into treatment, residential treatment, day treatments, counselors, psychiatrists, drug therapy. But some of them aren't ready for it yet. And what's so great is to be able to have the resources. What bothers me is when they, you're in a community where they don't have the resources. And that's one of the challenges we have in rural areas, is that there's a, you know, like rural mental health. I mean, you know, this is why primary care is really the front line of mental health in rural communities. But anyway, I think getting back to your point about establishing that relationship with the patient and meet them where they are.
Well, what do you do in a situation where, like, culturally mental health isn't something that you even approach the subject of? Like, do you just kind of wait and kind of do that same, like, you want to talk about it today, see you back at another time? Like, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah. So we did some research a number of years ago on the alignment between patients and providers on how patient-centered they are and how doctor-centered or provider-centered they are. There's a scale for this, and you can kind of study it. And what we really learned was patients tend to be a little more static, meaning that they're either more sort of like patient-centered, where they want more information, they want to be involved in shared decision-making, and some of them are very, you know, provider-centered and like, hey, doc, whatever you want me to take that pill for my blood pressure, that's fine. You don't need to give me options. Whereas providers, we tend to be more dynamic, and that you learn that over time to be dynamic with the patient. As you're getting to know them for the first time, you're like, ooh, this person does not want a lot of information. They don't want to make a lot of decisions. They want to be kind of told what to do, a little more paternalistic relationship. And you kind of work on that. And others, like you, immediately know, boy, this person's going to want to research this on the internet. They're going to want to get all the information. This is going to take 3 visits to figure this one out. So I think you learn that over time is that as a provider, you'll be dynamic. Patients tend to be a little more static.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You know, in Iowa, when I think of rural, I think of farming. I don't know if that's universally true, but, you know, it is Iowa. Are there specific challenges in working in farming communities?
Oh, you know, great question. You know, I think there are definitely, you know, I grew up in a farm community. So did you. Mm-hmm. All of us did, right?
Grandparents did.
Grandparents. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Close enough. Yeah, you're from the East Coast. You don't count. Okay.
Yeah, I'm. Yeah.
Hey.
I can't even keep a plant alive in my home, never mind in the ground outside.
There are farms on the East Coast. Which is one we know.
There are. That's true.
Yes. I'm from Indiana, just the second
farming
biggest city in Indiana,
exactly,
but like,
there.
My mom grew up in a town of 80, so like.
Hey, I grew up on Cape Cod. I can catch a clam.
Hey, that's so farming with itself.
They don't move that much.
They don't. No, they stay in one place.
It's basically gathering.
Yeah.
No, I think it gets at this issue of, excuse me, of, you know, what is unique to that community, whether it's, I mean, it can be ag-based, it could be forestry, it could be, you know, small farms, it could be large industrial farms, it could be hog confinements. You know, what are the challenges in that community? You know, there's often these communities that have large immigrant populations that provide the labor, mm-hmm. you know, take towns like, you know, Storm Lake, you know, other, you know, Columbus Junction. They have unique, you know, healthcare needs as well. And I think, you know, as a provider in those communities, you know, you quickly learn what those issues are. And that may be the reason you went there, because of the unique issues. You may end up someplace randomly because of a partner, a job, a change of scenery, whatever. But they're all unique, but you learn what they are. That's what's great about, you know, being a medical student and then evolving into practicing and PA school also, is that you learn to be adaptive. And, the people that don't learn to be adaptive struggle.
So what are the kinds of things in farming communities that you see as a provider?
Yeah, so one of the more tragic ones are just trauma. You know, I can remember as a kid, you know, a farmer showing up with part of his arm missing, you know, from a power takeoff that caught his,
dangerous.
Caught his, you know, his overalls. I remember once as a kid, you know, somebody showed up with their thumb severed off, and my dad handed it to me and said, get some ice from the fridge, we're going to the hospital. And I'm like, okay, let's go.
And
you
that's
know,
when he knew he would be a physician.
I just sat in the back seat with the cup. You know, so
that's a great personal statement.
But I think it's this idea that there are definitely trauma related things. You know, there's always going to be exposure related things that we just don't know. You know, what's going to happen over time?
Chemicals, pesticides.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a moving target.
So, as a healthcare provider, would you encourage people to discuss like farm safety behavior, like with your patients, or like understanding chemicals and how to properly store them? Like, is that something that we should be discussing with our patients, or is that something that we should let them like work out on their own?
Yeah, because I'm assuming that you could do that, or you could also say, well, you know your business.
Yeah, I think so. As you asked that, it reminded me of Dr. Christine Sinsky. She was in Dubuque for a long time as an internal medicine provider here. She and her husband Tom are both internists there. And then she worked for the AMA and did a lot of work in joy and practice. And she's mostly retired now. But I remember she did some work looking at how much time it would take you in a primary care visit to do all the things that mm-hmm. we're supposed to do from, mm-hmm. you know, counseling on seatbelts and wearing helmets and condoms and whatever else that you need to do all at the same time. And then you start getting into farm safety. I mean, there's only so much we can do, but I think being part of that community to learn when you feel like you can make a difference. I mean, like if a farmer has an old tractor that doesn't have, you know, proper roll bar, you know, apparatus on it, and they can't afford getting that, I don't know what you're going to do to help them. You know, they know that if the tractor rolls over, it will crush them. You know, so I think it's hard. I'm absolutely not an expert in it, but I think, you know, again, you get into that community, you learn what's going on. Being from Kelowna, you know what's going on.
Yeah, it's getting into occupational health stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made it to the second break. You tolerate us. If you can, consider donating or buying a sticker or something. Visit theshortcoat.com and help us do stuff without having to beg a dean for money. Thanks.
Are there studies about practitioner satisfaction in rural settings and whether that's, you know, higher or lower? Like, what can you tell us about that?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think we should just get, you know, the sorting hats like at Hogwarts. And, you know, when you show up, you just get assigned.
Yeah. But,
you know, So the whole issue of burnout and moral injury and all this kind of stuff is interesting, and it's nothing new. I mean, you know, there's burnout forever. I mean, and is it much worse? It's worse in some ways. I think it's better that we're studying it and trying to come up with what the causes and solutions are to it. You know, I struggle with this when, you know, people say they're unhappy with their job or with whatever situation they're in. It's like, you know, you have agency here. You have some control. You know, how much of this is you and how much is it the environment? So, you know, we've done work looking at rural providers. You know, is it that much different? I would say no, you know, because the challenges in healthcare that cause us to have burnout, it's not the relationship with the patients. It's not the fact that some of them die and have bad outcomes. It's the bureaucratic BS that we have to deal with. Or, you know, you can't hire somebody because of something in HR or all these things that are outside of our control. And I think that's as wherever you end up in practice, you know, do your daily serenity prayer and figure it out what it is that you can control and what you can't control. And I think that hopefully will help with your satisfaction and your joy.
So those things still exist no matter where you practice.
Absolutely.
Probably no matter what you do. That's
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not even a medicine thing. That's just an everything thing.
What I read an article recently. We sort of touched on this a little bit. I want to see if we can get a little more into it. I sent these guys an article that I found last night, an opinion piece that suggests we're getting the incentives for practicing rural, you know, in rural settings wrong. The financial incentives that we use to, you know, encourage physicians to relocate or to choose to practice in rural areas, they haven't really significantly improved things. Is that, you feel like that's the case?
I absolutely think it's the case. And I think that, you know, it's for policymakers, and now that I'm a policymaker in DC, you know, I can see where there's that incentive to be like, well, just let's throw money at the problem. And, you know, they have limited return. And, you know, are they a bad thing? If you're, you know, so if Alan, if you're going to go into practice in rural Iowa and there's $50,000 a year to pay off some of your debt, great, you know, all the better. But, you know, is that $50,000 a year for 4 or 5 years going to change your mind for what you're going to do? Probably not.
I mean, it seems like the hope is like, we'll pay off their student loans. if they come here and maybe they'll like it. You know, maybe they'll choose to stay there forever, right?
I feel like you'd have to like it first or somehow give some sort of option for people to understand what it's like first. Because otherwise, I feel like, kind of like somebody said, it feels like a sacrifice you're making.
Yeah.
If...
And it may feel more like the sacrifice if people are throwing money at you. Right,
exactly. Like, people always say that, like, oh, I loved, like, this thing was my hobby and I loved it until it turned into a job and then I hated it. And, like, I don't know. I'm afraid that sometimes that's what it is. I don't know.
That's very, I mean, it's studied out that once you start adding intrinsic extrinsic motivation to things that people were intrinsically motivated to do, the intrinsic motivation decreases. So if they love it and you're like, oh, but I'm going to pay you more to do it, they're going to like it less. That's just the nature of it. So yeah, I think we're throwing money at it. It's going to be perceived as this great sacrifice that they have to pay me more to do, you know? Right.
So what would you do?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Or were you going to say something before?
Well, I was going to say, I think another corollary to that is the way that we can use visa waivers. So for people who come to this country on J-1 visas for residency, so foreign medical grads who come to the U.S., can be on H-1 or J-1 visas. So if they're on a J-1 visa, they have to go back to their home country after residency. But there are waiver positions. The VA has them. States are granted them. And I don't think they've been studied well enough, because what you see happen, and this is mostly anecdotally, but we see some people go to the community or state, go into that practice, because that's the only way they can stay. Mm-hmm. They have to take it.
Yeah.
And the minute that it ends, some of them are out the door. And I'll give you a great example. A good friend of mine, Thor Half-Donnerson, he's now at the Mayo Clinic. He was a resident here, and then he was at the VA. You know, he took a J-1 position at the VA. And, you know, when it was over with, he stayed another 5-6 years and was great. And, you know, then we had somebody else took it. The day it was over with, they were out the door. And that's okay. You know, it served a purpose. And again, I like that point about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. I don't know how much we can change people's intrinsic motivation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's also this sort of ongoing conversation about, like, well, we can rely on, if we can't rely on having physicians, we can certainly rely on, or we hopefully can rely on APPs, like mm-hmm. physician assistants and nurse practitioners, to fill that void. How do you think about that?
Oh yeah, that's a big issue. And a big issue, like, in the VA, because we hire a lot of nurse practitioners and PAs for exactly that reason. Because one reason in the VA, we can only pay the maximum you can make as a salary is $450,000, which is what the president makes. So nobody can make more than the president. Mm-hmm. So because of that, high paying, specialties like dermatology, cardiology, oncology, neurosurgery, it's really hard to hire them because we can't pay them what the market allows us to pay or what the market would pay them. And so we do use a lot of advanced practice providers to fill that in. I think the most important thing, though, is how though they work as a team. Because, you know, if you're going to work in a cardiology clinic as a PA, you know, you didn't do a cardiology residency, mm-hmm. fellowship. I mean, that's not the same level of training. And you know that, and everybody knows that. So what are the things that you bring to be able to make that cardiologist be able to focus on the things that they can do, and you focus on the things that, you know, complement what they do? And I think that team-based approach is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. Our PA program actually requires us to do at least one rotation in a rural healthcare setting. And I think the goal of the program is to have us, like, fill in those gaps in the rural healthcare setting. But if, like, myself or my colleagues aren't interested in going into rural healthcare, then I think it defeats the point in some ways too. It's going back to that intrinsic motivation that we're trying to allow APPs to go into the setting. But if no one is still interested in doing that, I don't think they're going to have, like, the passion or the drive or, like, even the mindset of, like, working collaboratively in that environment to make sure that all the patients', like, needs are met in that situation too.
So if we can't use, or if money isn't the motivator that we want it to be, what would you do if you had your druthers? What would you do to convince people, like, hey, this is cool? work in rural America. Yeah.
Jeff, you I think hit it. And that is the pipeline. That this doesn't begin today. This began 15 years ago with those kids that are in, you know, elementary or junior high school, and getting them well educated, getting them the opportunities, getting that, you know, we should be thinking about the next 15 years, not, you know, 2 years from now. And what is that pipeline of people? Because we know the biggest predictor of people going to a rural area is people from a rural area. Yeah. I mean, all other variables taken away, money, you know, education, everything else, it's where you come from. I mean, I'm from Iowa. Would I be here otherwise? I don't know. Probably not. But I left, trained in Utah, and I'm like, well, I kind of like Iowa. I'm going to come back. And I think that's the way we need to be thinking about this. It's the long-term strategies. Yeah, we can throw in some short-term ones and see if they work. But it's the pipeline.
So you've got to start early.
Yeah. So, Jeff, I think maybe you want to say more about it, because that's what you're the one that brought it up.
Yeah, I mean, and I've had some people push back on it. They're like, well, some people from urban areas want to go to rural areas too. I'm like, yeah, but like law of large numbers, right? We're not looking at, I don't, N of 15, I don't care. Like, what are we looking at? Like, N of thousands of medical students. It's the ones that are from rural areas. What are we doing as a medical school to foster that with our youth? I mean, I've been part of programs that, you know, like STEM fairs and stuff with kids in Iowa City. But do we have an outreach program where we're sending, you know, medical students when they're on those family med rotations? Do they go to the local middle school? Do they go to the local high school? Little things like that is putting in their minds, like, this is you. This could be you. I'm from a rural area too. And you can do this and provide that service to your rural community. But until somebody plants that seed, I don't know. I will also say that as frustrating as it can be to have high turnover, things like with the J-1 visas where they stay in the area for a certain period of time and then they're gone, like it's more frustrating to have no coverage at all. And so I'm not opposed, since you're somebody that spends time in Washington, I wouldn't mind what I've seen a couple of our foreign exchange students, their programs, you know, they have like an actual GP, you know, they graduate medical school and they go into general practice. And then a couple of years later, they apply to residency. I kind of like that model. I like the idea of there be returning to at least some pipeline of GP in this country that we have let go of. I don't know. I wouldn't mind that, even if it's temporary, like, you know, everybody does it for a year or two before you go on to be a neurosurgeon and have your Porsche and your yacht or whatever.
Yeah, I think we should have a national service requirement, and I think healthcare would be one of those places we could start, you know, and you can opt out of it in various ways, and there's been lots of models for it, but yeah, I think, you know, there is no one solution to any problem, so let's come up with a lot of different ones and try them and see what sticks.
Yeah.
What's the most important thing you think all people should know about rural healthcare? Like, for people that are listening that might become doctors one day, for people that are listening that, I don't know.
For families,
yeah,
friends.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. The one thing, I don't know if there's a one thing, but I will say that the amount that we all learned collectively during the pandemic about what we can do by telemedicine, it leapt us forward leaps and bounds. And I say that because I've been doing telemedicine with my friends and family forever. I got more photos on my camera or my phone of skin lesions and injuries. And I always tell my friends and family, I say, listen, my job is to either keep you out of the emergency room, or if you need to be in the emergency room, get you there as quickly as possible. So they come to me with things, and I'm shocked at how many things I can take care of. And then as a hospitalist, we do telehospital medicine now. You know, we started that 5 years ago.
So that would be like you sit in your office and somebody calls you from the other side of the hospital?
No, we actually provide care in other hospitals.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and we use non-physician providers, PAs, nurse practitioners in those hospitals that don't have physicians. They'd have to close the unit otherwise. Mm. And so we provide the level of expertise that augments their skills, and they're there for the physical exam and being physically in the room with the patient and the family, and we're doing it all by video, and I can sit in my office and do it. I don't want to do it every day, but it's a really great like addition to my practice. And I think that's something, is that embracing telemedicine is something we should all be doing to the absolute maximum. Do we know when it's harmful? We're still learning that. There's probably too much of a good thing. And there's probably like the person who's getting primary care and never comes into clinic. That's probably not a good thing. But what's the alternative? Is the alternative, I think you're talking about somebody just walking out of a clinic and never being seen again. No, we want people to get health care. And so I think that's the one thing I would say about rural care is that we need to embrace all the modalities, and telemedicine, it's not solving all our problems, but it helps with a lot of them.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Before we let you go, Dr. Kaboli, is there a place where you might recommend interested students go to find out more about like what it means to practice in rural settings off the top of your head?
Well, I'd recommend, you know, for the students here, you know, doing, you know, summer MECO rotations are fantastic.
It's the Medical Education Community Orientation, I think is what it stands
yes.
for.
Yes. I never knew what it stood for. I just knew it was MECO. It was MECO 30 years and it's still MECO now. Yeah. So, yes. So that, I think, like, you know, somebody's saying about, you know, having opportunities to do rotations other places, you know, some of those you have to reach out for. Jeff said, you know, you went to South Africa, you know, again, it could be South Africa or it could be, you know, Southern Missouri. Just do something different. You know, I think just, again, I'm big into relationships. Talk to people,
yeah.
You know, send me a note if you want, you know, and connect you, you know, get connected to the right people to get new opportunities.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really, really nice talking and getting to know you and calling you a liar.
Love it.
Fallon, Jeff, Faith, Olivia, thanks to you guys too for hanging out with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And what kind of overstuffed fertilizer sack would I be if I didn't thank you, Shortcoats, for making us part of your week? If you're new here and you'd like what you heard today, follow the show wherever fine podcasts are available, like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube, although not for this show because my camera crashed in the middle of the show. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and ongoing support from the Writing and Humanities Program. Our music is by Dr. Vox and Catmosphere. I'm Dave Etler saying, don't let the bastards get you down. Talk to you in 1 week.
Hi, Shortcoats. Look, life in medical education, life in America, life in the world is often difficult. And I often wish I could help. All I have is this podcast, but in my wildest dreams, you have the support you need to lead a life of your choosing. You deserve to be happy, healthy, and successful in whatever ways you define those words. So if you need support because you've experienced racism, discrimination, harassment, mental health crises, I want you to be able to get the help that you need. And so I'm going to put some links in the show notes to some resources that you can use. But the bottom line is that for what it's worth, I see you. I know you're out there. I wish I could do more. Maybe I can in ways that I don't understand yet or know about. But I see you and I'm glad you're here and other people are too.
The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.